Welcome to the IPv6 Buzz podcast, where we dare to dive into the 128-bit address space wormhole. I'm Ed Horley with my co-hosts Tom Coffeen and Scott Hogue. And today we're going to be talking about Aaron, a little bit of IPv6 history and policy and what they're all up to with our guest, Mark Custers from Aaron. So let's jump right in and start off with some questions in terms of, number one, welcome to the show. But number two, maybe you can spend a little bit of time explaining to us a little bit of history around Aaron, and maybe the good place to start is, what does Aaron do? And maybe even better, what does Aaron actually stand for?
Of course, it's great to be here. And I'm the CTO of Aaron. And Aaron stands for American Registry for Internet Numbers. And we are the organization, one of five organizations worldwide, that hand out unique internet resources, IPv4 and IPv6 addresses, as well as autonomous system numbers, which are used to identify ISPs that connect on the internet. This is something that's happened from the very beginning of the internet. It was originally done by this really cool dude named John Postel, and he's well revered on the internet. This outgrew him. He actually handed it to an organization called SRI, who called it the SRI NIC. It was then passed on to a DoD contract that a company called Network Solutions ran starting in 1991. And fast forward, in 1997, American Registry for Internet Numbers was formed out of Network Solutions, and it is a nonprofit organization held accountable by its membership, which are ISPs, to the community to give out IP space.
Wow. Okay. That was like great and concise. So Aaron's principal job, hand out autonomous system numbers and hand out IPv4 and IPv6 address allocations to their member organizations.
Yep. You made it even more concise.
Wow. So cool. Well, and we're here to talk about V6, obviously, because we think that's pretty important. So I was sort of curious, maybe you can give us a little bit of insight into how Aaron thinks about IPv6, how that plays out, maybe a little bit about policy, what's driving Aaron to be, you know, so interested in V6, besides the fact that, you know, that's our only way going forward. But it'd be great to hear a little bit of discussion point around that.
Yep, of course. So Aaron, of course, as initially giving out IPv4 addresses, was very much involved in watching and following the sort of selection of the IPv6 address family. And our CEO was actually one of those initial panelists that decided out of the three major contenders for IPv6, he was the one that helped select IPv6 as we know it today. And Aaron is one that enforces and sets and takes care of policy, but we're not the ones that create policy. It's actually our members that create policy in terms of what should be done in terms of giving out IPv4 and V6 space. And so what you have here is a bottom-up process where the community, which are organizations, even interested members, who come to Aaron meetings, they help develop policy that Aaron actually uses to allocate V4, V6, and autonomous system numbers.
Very cool. I see Aaron fitting in a couple different roles besides actually allocating out the addresses themselves, right? You have a set of policies about the addresses, right? And how the community has to work around those. But in addition, there's a little bit of an advocacy role too. And I'd be interested to hear how that sort of plays out with what you guys are doing today around IPv6 and around the policies themselves.
That's a very good question. So Aaron is actually involved in, first of all, sort of helping the community understand what Aaron really truly does. And the community helps Aaron defend that role, saying, hey, look, we're not the internet police. We're actually here and follow the rules that have been defined by you, the community, for us to actually abide by. And this goes just beyond the community. It actually goes to government. Governments and the ITU, where we've been called to sort of educate people on this bottom-up process and how these policies are actually formed and how they're actually evolve over time and the allocation of V4 and V6 addresses, especially V6 in this case.
Mark, I have a question related to how Aaron formulates policy. It just intuitively, it seems like if the greater participation you have from the community of folks that are going to rely on Aaron resources, maybe the more confident you could be that the policies are serving the community. And it just sort of makes me wonder, Over time, have you seen, what has the level of participation been like? Have you seen that increase or decrease? And has there been like a resulting, additional tension and sort of coming up with policy that the community feels like they can live with?
Another really good question. So over time, I've been involved with Aaron since almost the very beginning. Actually, I helped set up Aaron as an engineer working for Network Solutions. And at that point, it was a amazing thing to see where the community said, oh, now we have something that we can help maintain as opposed to a privately owned organization actually allocating these IP addresses and us not really understanding what was happening. And the initial sort of forayness was an internet RFC, RFC 2050, where we tried to make it sort of clear how these policies were going to be enforced and followed. It was a very controversial thing at that point, but it sort of evolved where the community actually had a bigger say into what we've done. And this is done by policy meetings, public policy meetings that we have twice a year. And so self-selected individuals, those who are interested, come to our meetings, and they're in all over the United States, Canada, or down even sometimes in the Caribbean, where we get together and policy is debated. What's interesting about this is policy is debated by the members. The organization, Aaron, actually just facilitates the structure and make the debate happen. It's really the members themselves that have the debate, and they're the ones that choose the policies and how they're actually put together.
The policies that result, then it's kind of like, well, this is a community effort, and so if there are challenges in terms of how, those additional consumers of Aaron resources are viewing the policy, then it's almost like the answer would just be, well, hey, if you're frustrated with this for some reason with how the policy is laid out, then please show up at the meetings and participate. Is there at least a little bit of that sort of sense around and around how the policy is received and the response to that?
Yeah, and not only that, there's also this thing, it's called the public policy process. And it's this process in which people can actually put out their what they want as a policy, and they can actually put it out on a mailing list, the public policy mailing list. We call it PPML, which is at aaron.net. What they can do is they can actually sort of argue for the policy that they want to promote. And if they get enough people behind it, then it's actually put into the policy process. And it's then debated at the policy meeting as well as on a mailing list. So you don't have to go to a meeting. You can actually just follow what's going on a mailing list, PPML.
Let's switch gears a little bit. Maybe talk about how Aaron took IPv6 from an experiment into production, because I know you folks are obviously running v6 in order to be able to support it. So a little bit of journey. Maybe tell us how Aaron spun it up and how they're making use of it themselves, because obviously you're both a provider, but you're also a customer too.
That is true, Ed. So one of the things that shortly after V6 became the standard, and in 2003, actually Aaron started experimenting with V6 ourselves. We wanted to eat our own dog food. So actually we had to know the right people within organizations to go ahead and set up V6. And it was tough at the very beginning. It's very tough. It wasn't until 2008 before there's really good commercial, hardcore, reliable service available for people to use on V6.
In terms of the production side, what exactly is Aaron actually releasing out there? Is it mainly just the web presence, or are there other services that Aaron's actually providing on V6?
Every service that we have is offered on both V4 and V6. So our website, of course, is V4 and V6. One of our biggest and heaviest uses is DNS. We actually put out authoritative DNS for the reverse tree, and that's a very heavily used service. And we also have directory services, and there's really three protocols that it's comprised of. And those services are also using both V4 and V6. Finally, our latest sort of offering is some security services. One is called RPKI, Resource Public Key Infrastructure, is what the acronym is. And what it does is a way of actually helping secure routing across the internet. And that's available on both V4 and V6 as well.
Yeah, fantastic. So that means for anyone who wants to interact with Aaron as an organization, they have the confidence to know it doesn't matter V4, V6, they're going to be able to interact with you folks in terms of any technical attributes, plus what you guys are supporting as products out to the community itself, right?
That's correct. And now there's a couple of cases where sadly V4 is the only alternative available, especially for third-party services. And those are things that if there's a V6 entity that has that particular service that it's not part of our core mission that we're going to purchase for someone else, we need to have V6 available for that service. There's been a couple of cases of those things over time that people have wanted to have V6 that just haven't been able to get there yet because their hosting provider doesn't support V6. And so we've talked about to the hosting provider and the application services provider saying, what is your V6 roadmap? And make sure it's really soon and we'll use you, but only for a certain amount of time. Otherwise, we need to have a V4 and V6 available candidate on all available services.
So these would be things like cloud services that maybe Aaron utilizes, or maybe like a financial package that you're using in-house, things like that. Is that what you're referring to?
That's correct. So for example, one of the things that we have is, since Aaron's a membership-based service, one of the things that we have to have is annual elections. And the election service that we use is V4 only. So when people vote, sadly, they're voting over V4 only. This is something that the vendor is working on, but they're dependent on their cloud service provider to provide V6 service for them to actually provide back to us.
Ah, got it. Well, that totally makes sense. I mean, it's a journey, right? It's not overnight. You don't snap your fingers and it's all there. But it's wonderful that Aaron's putting that sort of requirements on your vendors to say, hey, we need to get V6 supported.
Every third-party service that Aaron has, we request, in many cases, mandate V6. Even with the people that we rent our space from our building from, for example.
Oh, really? Yeah. That sounds interesting.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, so Mark, it's also pretty obvious for the folks that have been working with V6 for some time that Aaron has also proved to be a tremendous resource in terms of not just defining the policies to get the addresses and to make that, to streamline that process to the extent possible, but also a tremendous degree of advocacy and the sharing of information for, you know, the best path forward for adopting IPv6. I'd imagine there are quite a few of our listeners that are aware of that activity, but there's probably an equal number, if not more, who may not know that Aaron actually has, you know, advocated V6 for a long time and provided resources to help folks adopt it. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so advocacy has gone on different levels. One is, as I mentioned before, was on the government level. Having governments understand the importance of V6 and the bottom-up policy process that Aaron employs, as well as the other regional registries. But the other thing is also going into outreach. Typically, people go to various tech conferences around, and we've done outreach at these conferences and done sort of, instead of having our own booth, we may have our own booth, but we also go to all the other people at these booths and we say, hey, I see this really cool service you have. Do you offer it over V6? And that starts a conversation with those particular vendors and saying, oh, we didn't realize that we need to have V6. And one of them was, like, for example, smart TVs. And I think we were talking with Sony, and they actually went back to the drawing table and said, we need to put V6 stack in our product going forward. So those sort of things were things that Aaron has helped facilitate. There's conferences we've gone to, there's booths that we put up. We also have outreach in various forums. We have a social media awareness site, Team Aaron, for example. And all these things are used to help heavily promote V6.
Excellent.
You know, enterprises, they need to obtain their address resources from Aaron. So how much should they get? Does Aaron give them guidance on that, or do they just request and you give them exactly what they asked for? What if they got a block that was too small and they need to get a bigger block because now they really thought through their addressing? How does that process work, or how does an enterprise get started?
Yeah, that's a good question, Scott. So essentially, the policy is actually fairly clear in terms of setting of people actually asking for and getting space. If you have V4 already, you're essentially qualified already to get V6 space. Or if you are planning on being multi-homed, or if you have planning on doing 50 assignments within 5 years, for example, you can get space from Aaron. You can go ahead and set that up. And typically, what we'll do is we use what's called a sparse allocation method, where you take a block of addresses, you split it in half and say, okay, this is our first assignment. And then you go to it, split it in half again, and you do another assignment and you keep on going, keep on going, keep on going. So it allows for some fairly large size adjacent blocks from where you're at. Beyond that, we'll initially give out a slash 48 and we'll reserve, and most times out of a 44. So there's space to grow within and still able to keep just a single announcement to the community.
Okay. And I know there's probably policy that drives how much an organization can qualify to receive. They probably need some justification, right, to apply and get an allocation.
Yep. You definitely have to apply. There's justification that you need to apply for. And all that is driven by policy. For example, as I mentioned before, you have to have a V4 assignment from Aaron or one of his predecessors, the InterNIC Network Solutions, SRINIC, et cetera. You have to intend to immediately be V6 multi-homed, have 13 end sites if you're an ISP, have 2,000 V6 addresses within a year or if not more, or in 200/64 subnets within 1 year, for example. So all these things are used as sort of criteria in figuring out what size space makes sense for that particular person who's asking for the space.
The good news is that you guys have a really simple policy posted up on the website, right? In terms of giving out allocations, there's some pretty easy, straightforward number of sites configuration to sort of do some default numbers with, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah,
that's a wonderful resource for folks to, if you're first exploring that and trying to figure out at least a ballpark or what I call a swag number for a starting point, that's really a great place to start. And I'm sure Tom has more to pitch in and say about that, being the address planning guy. But if you're just trying to, you know, get an eyeball and understand where you should be starting at, I think they're pretty not bad rules of the road or some guardrails.
Yeah, absolutely. The folks that aren't familiar with what's in the number resource policy manual before they start to try to figure out what allocation size they should really be asking for, you know, it's a good idea to review that information. One of the things that I've been saying for quite some time to enterprises, and it seems to come from, you know, sort of the advocacy and the messaging that I get from Aaron and from Aaron Policy, is, you know, that there's enough address resources to address your network in the way that makes sense for you to do so that it's operationally consistent and scalable and all the things that are now difficult to do with the lack of IPv4 address space, and to do so in a very affordable way. And so a lot of the folks that we talk to are enterprises, and they may not have a lot of experience working with Aaron because, you know, back in the day, they had one of the admins got a block of V4 addresses and that's what they've been using, and they've been using a lot of private address space and they haven't really thought about it too much. And so I think it can be a little bit intimidating, but Aaron has done a tremendous job in making it less intimidating and providing the information to ask for the right amount of space and to move forward with confidence with IPv6. So that's really something that makes the whole process so much easier that, you know, than it might've been otherwise.
I think the other thing that's really important, and Mark might be able to comment on this, the philosophy is entirely different V4 to V6 in terms of address allocation, right? And so policies that Aaron has had to take in place for V4 in many ways from the community basis were sort of punitive, right? And to try and conserve V4 address space. And I think the viewpoint for V6 is we want adoption, we want people using addresses, and therefore there should be a different philosophy. And I don't want to put words in Aaron's mouth by any stretch of the imagination, so I'll let Mark do that instead. But you know, maybe talk a little bit about the difference in terms of, you know, how that policy works and why the community sort of set that up the way they did.
You're absolutely right. So the thing is with V4, it was all about address conservation and about trying to get as much as you can out of it because we were going to run out, and we did run out. And with V6, it's like, hey, let's make sure you have enough to last you for a long, long time and able to architect your networks in a way that you can actually handle growth. It's definitely a different philosophy. And I think there was a good podcast that you guys had a little while ago that actually discussed how to go ahead and set that up.
Yeah, I mean, it's important for folks to understand that Aaron Policy, it's not Mark and John and, you know, Richard all sitting in a room and saying that this is what the policy sets really need to be, and this is how we need to go about it. The advocacy really is, and the point about the advocacy is saying that this is what the community wants to have as a policy set. We want people to adopt V6. It should be a low barrier to entry to ask for a larger allocation than what our default policy says, versus maybe what V4 had in the past, which was much more about like saying, hey, we need to see proof that you're actually using the addresses, you've got a good structured plan put together, that you're going to be good custodians of the address space that we do give you, things of that nature. And with V6, I'm not saying it's a wasteful policy, but it certainly is a very generous and gracious policy that Aaron is now implementing in order to be able to give enterprises, service providers, anyone else who wants to be able to get address space from Aaron. It's really generous. Don't be shy. Ask for what you think you may need to grow to. Aaron probably is more than happy to accommodate what you want to do.
You're absolutely right, Ed. And one of the things that as an engineer, I always get saying, well, I got to read this policy document. Oh man, to figure out how much space I need. There's actually a really well-written article that's on the Team Aaron website that is written by a guy named John Sweeting, who talks about what you need to do to get your space from Aaron. And it's all written in very simple English, stuff that even I can understand. TeamAaron.net/get6, D-E-T, the number 6. It has just a really simple English way of actually describing what you need to do to get your space. As you mentioned, Ed, you'll get plenty of it.
Are there other things that people really should be paying attention to around Aaron right now and policies and maybe even how can folks get involved with it?
So actually, it's interesting you bring that up. We will be having a meeting here this fall, and it's going to be in Austin. If you want to see it up front and center, how the policy process actually occurs, starting on 31st of October to 1st of November in 2019 in Austin, Texas. And we're actually going to be having basically 2 days of debates on V6 policies, the emerging things that are coming out. So it's a good time. People seem to enjoy it, and some good policies come out of it as a result.
And I'd like to highlight too, because like myself, don't always get to travel or you don't necessarily want to travel. Aaron makes it available to participate remotely. You can definitely listen in, hear what folks are doing. They pipe everything out on the internet, V4 and V6. I participated remotely and in person when it happened to be here local in San Francisco. I was doing stuff here and went ahead and darted into the city and participated directly in person. But there have been plenty of times where I've jumped on remotely to be able to sort of hear what's going on.
And it's actually available on YouTube, and we have a transcription service. So if you want to read along as they go about it, you're welcome to do that too. And it's also a Slack channel to go ahead and ask your questions. So we definitely want to make it easy for those people who are remote and can't make it to that location as well.
Since it's back to school time, Professor Mark, could you please read us children a passage from the Number Resource Policy Manual? Many enterprises have the impression that they have enough IPv4 address space to sustain themselves indefinitely, and they get the impression that they can always get more. They can always just come and ask for more. Maybe you could talk about kind of the address transfer policy or process. How does that work for an enterprise?
Good question. It's no secret that V4 addresses are bought and sold on the marketplace now. And there's many enterprises that said, hey, I have more than enough V4 addresses. Let me sell my spare to make a little bit of money on the side. So they'll get together with a broker, a V4 broker, and work with Aaron on making sure that the space is legitimately held by that particular organization. And they'll use a pre-qualified purchaser, essentially, to make that transaction occur. And the only thing that Aaron is involved with is, okay, the people that you're getting the addresses from is legit, and the people that you're getting the address are being sent to is legit. And, of course, there's some small bit of justification that is required, but it happens, and it's sort of free-flowing now.
Kind of like a matchmaker, but for address space, friendly, /16, likes walks on the beach, looking for a long-term relationship, eligible bachelor, cloud provider needs V4 address space. And then you kind of, you enforce, the blood test and the waiting period, and you hitch them up. How it works.
Actually, we're more of like the marriage registry, right?
Justice of the peace.
Justice of the peace, yes, absolutely. We're not the one that's going out there and actively promoting any of this. Yeah, we just record it.
Okay, I get it.
Tipping a little bit from what Scott was talking about, maybe you can talk a little bit of history about IPv4 depletion, because I think that's sort of interesting for the audience if they haven't heard before. What was that whole policy thing about Aaron sort of saying like, hey, this is it. We're just going to rock it straight into the ground. No more V4, right? maybe a little bit of context around that so people understand what exactly happened there.
It's interesting. There's five regional registries. Most of the other regional registries had this sort of soft landing policy where they said, well, what we're going to do is we're going to take some of our free pool and we're going to hold it to the side. And when we get to the point where we no longer have this, all this address stuff, we'll give out small bits of address space to people who come into it. Like, for example, if you're a new organization, you get a /22 from Ripe, which is a European equivalent to Aaron in North America. Aaron didn't follow that. Aaron said, we're just going to run this to the ground. We are going to take all the V4 addresses that we have, and if people ask for it and they can justify it, they will get the space. There was only two outliers of that. One is there's in the policy document, there's some set aside, V4 space set aside for those people who need V4 to transition to V6. And the other part is core infrastructure. If you have services that are considered core infrastructure, then you can get a small modicum of V4 space from us. Otherwise, everything else is market-based.
Okay, so why don't we talk really quickly about that reserve space? Because I think that might be interesting for a few folks in the, on the service provider side. So we set aside some address space that was really designed for a transition need requirement, right? Is that really what it's for?
Yep, it's intended for a transition.
Okay, and so that's really just to help bridge the gap when maybe a new transition technology comes out or there's a small amount of needed space for some translation components and a service provider or someone appropriately large enough actually needs some addresses for that specific purpose.
That is correct. Whether there be some sort of 6-to-4 address translation that occurs, whether it be a CGN, you name it, where there's V6 and V4 mixed together. And if they need V4 to actually talk to the parts of the internet that don't understand V6 yet, they will have that ability to do so.
Okay, great. And then there's an additional sort of like an equivalent add-on to the RFC 1918 space that we did that was an allocation that's basically for that reserve purpose for the service providers too, but it's sort of in the private address space to be able to sort of make sure that they had some address space to be able to operate in. And it's been interesting. I think Scott and I have both seen cloud service providers, folks that are deploying in cloud service providers, starting to use some of this address space for their own purposes because they ran out of RFC 1918 space and they're using it for that purpose. But it was really never what it was intended for. It's sort of fascinating watching how people tweak what's available to them and using things maybe outside of the scope, but seeming to work or bend their way around the rules. It's just more of an observation than anything else. But I don't know if Aaron's seen that also.
There's a squatting that goes on from people in the past who have run out of 1918 address space for their management plane, et cetera, within their ISP. They squatted on space that's U.S. government owned, for example, DOD, that isn't supposed to see the light of day on the internet, and they're using that space. It's all over the place. But definitely those times are coming to an end. V6 is really kind of becoming more mature. Now a lot of those addressing devices that you may have in your core infrastructure may have V6, the V6 stack on them. So instead of using 1918 address space, you can use V6 for it. So you can manage your interfaces that way. My ISP actually does that.
Very cool. Was there anything else that you wanted to share maybe around best practices and other things that you've seen folks that are successful in deploying IPv6? Some quick thoughts and some information you want to share with the audience around that?
One of the things that's interesting is when you go out there and you're looking for vendors that you want to use for your setup, one of the check boxes is, hey, do you have V6 support? They will invariably say yes, but the big thing to do is really drill down. Okay, what does yes really mean here? Do you have parity of services between V4 and V6? Are they equal in both cases? Or yes, you have V6, but you have only a subset available. We had this actually with our load balancers years ago where the vendor says, yes, we have V6 support. And then we actually got it, put it into place. And as we talked about a little bit earlier, Aaron services all have to run over V6 publicly on the internet. We have our load balancers in front of that need to support V6. And it was sad to see that the features that we wanted to use were not available because they were only available on V4 and not V6. And when they did come out with V6, we were like their alpha testers. That was really painful. So the big thing is really going down and making sure that the vendors really do have the feature parity between V4 and V6 as you do your selection. That's probably the biggest thing I have. There's a bunch of case studies that people have done on the TeamAaron.net site that are actually very good as well on successful deployments. We've had our own successful deployments, but we're just essentially an enterprise, and a fairly well-known enterprise at that. But it's worked out quite well for us. And but it's worked out very well for others too. And there's some big names in those case studies that are available on the TeamAaron.net website.
Well, unlike V6, we've run out of space for this podcast. So thanks again to today's guest, Mark Kosters with Aaron. Mark, how can folks follow up with you on the internet? Is there blogs, books, public appearances, anything else?
I prefer email, mark@aaron.net. And I also have a LinkedIn profile, linkedin.com. You can search for me, Mark Kosters. I have a Twitter account, but I'm rarely on it. It's M Kosters, M, capital M, capital K, zero, S-T-E-R-S, all lowercase. And one of the things I'll mention, if you ever want to look at sort of the early days of the internet, there's a really good book that shows the sort of the boilermaking sort of episodes that occurred back in the early 90s. And the book's called Names, Numbers, and Network Solutions, The Monetization of the Internet. I lived through that, and it was a fascinating time. And we're seeing some of those results with the monetization and the success of the internet that we have today.
Oh, fantastic. Thanks for the recommendation on that one.
Thank you.
You can reach the IPv6 Buzz podcast on Twitter at IPv6Buzz. And you can also hit up each of us on Twitter. Tom is at IPv6Tom. Scott is at Scott Hoag. And Ed is at E. Horley. Thanks for listening to the IPv6 Buzz. You can find us on the Packet Pushers or any of your favorite podcast apps. Just search for IPv6 Buzz. And please check out all the other great technical content over at the Packet Pushers at packetpushers.net. So long and until next time, we'll see you on the internet. The IPv6 internet, that is.
Thanks for listening to IPv6 Buzz, a podcast devoted to truth, justice, and 128 bits of address space. IPv6.